Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is George Werthner. He's the former Ecological Projects Director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. Currently, he's the Executive Director of Public Lands Media. He's an ecologist and wildlands activist. He's published 38 books on environmental issues and natural history, including such environmentally focused books as Welfare Ranching, Wildfire, Thrillcraft, Energy, and most recently, Protecting the Wild. Today, we're going to talk again about forest fires, and this time about the United States Forest Service's attempts to use the threat of forest fire for yet another chainsaw massacre. So first, as always, thank you for your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Yes, thank you for having me.
So can you give, I know that we've talked explicitly about the role of fire in western forests especially. Can you give a brief introduction to that? And then can you connect that to global warming? And then can you connect it to the propaganda? And then we'll move into the Forest Service's use of fire as an excuse to kill forests.
Sure. Well, the first thing I would say about fire is almost all western ecosystems, with very few exceptions like alpine tundra and the very wet temperate rainforests in the coast of Alaska, used to be periodically visited by wildfire. The temporal scale, in other words, the timing of those fires varied greatly depending on the vegetation and topography and ecosystems. So areas that were low elevation and dry, this is just generalization, low elevation and dry tended to have more frequent fires, while higher elevations and wetter sites had long periods of time that were fire-free but would still eventually burn. So something like the Olympic rainforest on the coast of Washington might go 1,000 years without a fire, but under the right circumstances would still have a fire come through. And the circumstances are that you tend to have extended drought period, low humidity, high temperatures, and most importantly, high winds to get a significantly large fire, particularly in the wetter, higher elevation forests. At a lower elevation, where it's drier, and the sort of poster child for that is the ponderosa pine forests around the west, fires would be more frequent and tend to be less have a lower mortality of trees. In other words, the larger, older trees typically survived fires, because the fires were frequent enough, they just led to the death of just the smaller trees. And whereas the higher elevation fires often were called stand replacement fires, in that they often had a significant amount of mortality of even the older, bigger trees. And fire has always been around. It's been in sagebrush ecosystems, been in grasslands, it's been in all the way up into the subalpine forest. And the plants and animals in those different ecosystems are adapted to fire. For example, even though we tend to think of fire, or I should say the public tends to think of fire as, quote, a destructive agent, for many plants and animal species, they actually depend on fire. They abhor green forests. Green forests are a place that they can't survive in, or they survive better in burnt forests. So the snag forests that result after a fire have the second highest biodiversity found in most western ecosystems. And that surprises a lot of people, but if you think about it, the fire creates the snags, which fall to the ground and create habitat for small voles and other mammals. Amphibians like salamanders tying under the logs, you get lots of insects. Native bees, for example, like to live in down logs and soil under logs, and they actually increase after a large fire. And the flowers come in after a fire and so forth. So the fires can be, the better way to think about it is fires rejuvenate the ecosystem. They may change it, but they're not necessarily, to use a sort of a propaganda word, destructive or catastrophic. Though the pejorative terms, it's much better to just say that the fire is a natural ecological process that changes the ecosystem, but some species benefit and some lose, but in the end, it's all part of sort of the larger functioning ecosystem.
You know, this reminds me of a conversation I had with a fisheries biologist on the Olympic Peninsula, and she was telling me that she works on a river she loves that is not dammed, and it floods frequently and changes course. You know, we've been lied to as to what rivers are. Rivers, you know, they writhe like snakes across the landscape. They're not supposed to stay in one channel. And
right.
And she said every time the river floods, it breaks her heart because and makes a new channel. It breaks her heart because of all the fish and the frogs and the salamanders and the trees and the deer and everybody else who was killed in the flood. It just breaks her heart. But at the same time, it makes her really happy because this is what the river does and it makes new habitat. And so she had this great line about it is short-term habitat loss for long-term habitat gain. And that line is always, when she said that, it just slapped me in the face. It's a beautiful line. And so, really, the way you're describing fire, would you say the same thing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is exactly the same kind of thing, how river systems have, an annual flood, and then they have 100-year floods and 500-year floods, and that's analogous to how fires are across the landscape. You have the very, you have the equivalent of an annual flood. Very common to have small wildfires, but they don't burn much of the landscape. 99% of the fires that occur annually in the western United States burn less than 100 acres, and most of them burn less than 1 acre. So they don't really account to very much acreage. And then mixed in with that, many small fires are occasional large fire that might burn 10,000 or even 100,000 or more acres. But they're very rare, and they only occur under very unusual circumstances, like I said, particularly drought and high winds. But those fires actually are the major influence on landscapes because they change so many acres in a short period of time, just like a 100-year or a 500-year flood on a river has a significant change to river ecosystems. And they're both completely natural. And, a river that doesn't flood anymore, like the ones that have been dammed, have been shown to no longer function properly. Sediments accumulate. You get lack of regeneration from species like cottonwood that rely on flooding and so forth. And it's the same thing in a forest ecosystem. If the only thing we had were small fires, that would significantly negatively impact our forested ecosystems. And that's a concept that's foreign to a lot of people, particularly in the timber industry. The timber industry and a lot of people in the Forest Service and other agencies have come to grips with the idea that some fire, in their view, is okay. And the okay fire is fires that are small, that don't burn many acres, that don't kill a lot of trees. But those fires actually are pretty insignificant in terms of how ecosystems function. And the fires that they tend to want to try to stop through various strategies like logging the forest, those fires, the large ones, are the ones that are ecologically important. And if we were to eliminate them, we would be eliminating, one of the major processes that makes forests function. And the problem is that too many people that come out of forestry schools are taught to think of forests as wood products. And they have a really tough time changing their viewpoint. So when a fire, kills trees and burns, makes them less suitable for timber, they consider that a loss. Instead, if you think about it ecologically, you welcome such fires because you realize that they create all this new habitat and new opportunities for all sorts of species.
So this may be a bit of an abrupt jump, But let's jump to some proposed changes for how the Forest Service is planning on, I don't even know what to say, that the Forest, because I don't want to say the Forest Service is attempting to, oh, here's what I want to say. I don't want to say that the Forest Service is attempting to deal with fire, but instead what I want to say, that there is a latest attempt by the Forest Service to use the excuse of fire as to facilitate further deforestation, to further handing over of trees to the timber industry. I'll read just a little bit. One revision in a proposed there's a proposed changes by the USDA, which is oversees the Forest Service. One of the revisions would eliminate the requirement for a thorough environmental study before permitting mining on blocks of land up to a square mile. So just take any of this anywhere you want.
Well, yeah, I mean, what is happening is a couple of things. One is we are seeing larger fires than in the more recent past. That has to be put into context. I'm going to deviate a little bit to provide
please,
the context.
Please do.
That is, whenever we have had dry, extended drought conditions, we have seen large wildfires. So, and when it's cooler and moister, we see fewer large wildfires. So if you go back in time, you don't have to go back very far, between about the 1940s and the 1980s was a cool, moist period in the West. And that's when the Forest Service in particular sort of got real, you know, into the business of fighting fires. And they were fooled or led to believe that they were successful at suppressing fires, when in fact nature was successful at suppressing fires by keeping it cool and moist. But during that time period, we didn't have very many large fires. And then in the late 80s, with Yellowstone National Park being a good signal of that change, it got much more drier, and we started having some of these really severe droughts around the West. You know, California had a drought that they called a 1,000-year drought. It hadn't been that dry in 1,000 years. And not surprisingly, there were lots of large wildfires in California. And what this has done is it's traumatized a lot of people, because they remember, at least a lot of people in the agency got their start in the 70s and 80s when there were large fires. So they think that this is something that is very unusual. However, if you go back, for example, the 1910 burn that burned across, Idaho and Montana, sometimes called the Big Burn, that burned 3 to 3.5 million acres in just a matter of days. We haven't had another fire that big in the last century at all. And not any time recently either, even though everybody's saying we're having these massive fires. And there were periods of time in the 20s and 30s where, by some estimates, as much as 40 to 50 million acres burned across the Western United States, and today, if 10 million acres burn, that's considered, you know, a record year for fires. So we have to have some context to view fires, and they are getting bigger, but they're not out of any kind of historical norm given the conditions we're experiencing. And those conditions, however, that we're seeing today are largely due to human influences on climate. In other words, up until the 1970s and 80s, most estimates, there was a worry that we were going to go into an ice age because the climate was tending to get cooler. And then as CO2 has accumulated in the atmosphere, we've seen warmer and warmer temperatures and more extreme weather conditions, and a lot of that is feeding these large fires. That isn't to say that the climate-induced fires are not something to be concerned about, but you also have to put it in the context that we have seen, at least up to this point, periods of time in the past where the same sort of large fires occurred, and it was you know, the forest didn't disappear, and the, you know, things went on. What will happen in the future is hard to predict because we're going into unknown territory here with the CO2 in the atmosphere and how warm things will get. But right now, they're not outside of any really historical norm. But the agencies will constantly refer back only about 30 years, you know, they'll go back and say, well, you know, in the 1970s and 1980s, we didn't have very many large fires, now we're having all these large fires, and it's something because of fuel buildup, we have to do something about it. Push, all during the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, fuel was building up, just quite naturally, because it builds up when it's cool and moist and there aren't large fires. So that was sort of more or less a natural situation that was induced by climate, now we're seeing the results of a changing climate and how that enhances fire spread and occurrence.
You know, okay, before we go over to the recent Forest Service thing, I have three questions, if I can remember them all. One of them is,
okay.
So it occurs to me, when you just said the thing about the fuel buildup, what you mean by fuel buildup is really small trees and underbrush, right? I mean, that's what the fuel is. Is that correct? And also duff on the forest floor. Yeah. Am I correct so far?
Yeah, you are. And let me highlight a thing before you go further, and because this is an important point. What burns in the forest fire is not big trees. It is the fine fuels. It is the grasses, the small trees, the cones, and that sort of thing. And that is why, after even a high-severity fire where most trees are killed, you have snag left over, because trees don't usually burn up in a forest fire. And that's a very important thing for people to understand. It's the fine fuels that support fires, not the big trees, which is why, circling back to the Forest Service, when they go out there and they want to cut larger trees, claiming that it will reduce fires because they're removing fuels, they're not removing the fuels that burn in a forest fire. They're removing trees that survive as snags after a fire.
And they're removing trees that are worth the most money, too, of course.
Yes, well, of course, that's why they're doing it.
So what I was going to get at was, you know, earlier I sort of compared this to a river flooding. But if we look at it not as fuels, but instead as certain populations that are increasing, we could almost see the fire kind of like lynx and hare populations, where or viruses and some population, where you get some population that increases. So you had from the 60s or the 40s through the 70s, where conditions were great for all of this undergrowth to build up, for all these, we can call them fuel, but for right now let's call them living beings. But when you get an accumulation of living beings, oftentimes a predator will come in. And I don't want to push this metaphor too far, but it's creating circumstances. Nature has a way of dealing with that. So if you get too many rats or too many rabbits, a lot of times that just makes a very happy virus or bacteria to come in and bring the population back down. So this is like, okay, the forest is getting to a point where there's, what's the word I'm looking for? Homeostasis? Where, you know, there gets to be too many, so that's going to be a way to sort of regulate. Do you see what I'm trying to get at with this?
Oh yeah. I use the metaphor that wildfires like wolves on a deer herd, that they tend to reduce the population of deer herd and in general take out the individuals that are less fit or less lucky, as the case may be, and then reset the stage for more deer growth, because now there's less deer competing for the food, and they grow again until the next time that the wolf population can grow large enough again to have a significant predator effect. And so, I mean, the temporal scale of these things and the spatial scales are very important, and I think a lot of our confusion or the way we think about things is partly due to temporal and scale and the spatial scale. So, for example, during that period of time, the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, when it was particularly moist and cool, the a lot of the, particularly the higher elevation farmers, didn't experience much wildfire, and they were building fuels all that time quite naturally because they tend to not burn very frequently, hundreds of years often between large fires. And so it's completely normal to have that kind of buildup. But at some point, the stage is reset through fire or, in some cases, other events like beetle outbreaks. I hate using the term outbreaks because it's normal, but beetles will attack some of these trees and cause a fair amount of mortality as well on a periodic basis. But they almost never are able to kill off, 100% mortality over a certain larger area, and that's where the spatial component comes in. You might find a fire has 100% mortality over 1,000 acres, but it doesn't have 100% mortality over 1,000,000 acres. It will be a mosaic with a whole lot of areas that are not burned at all. And depending upon what kind of spatial scale and temporal scale you use, you can come to entirely different conclusions about what the effect was of a wildfire or beetles.
So the second, thank you. The second of my three questions was, you mentioned, I think it was called the Big Burn. And what was the one called the Great Blowdown? Is that the same one or is that a different one? And can you give just a couple more examples of pre-1940 humongous fires, just so we know that the Big Burn was not a one-off?
Well, there was a big, huge fire in Wisconsin. I can't even remember the name of it at this point, but it actually killed quite a number of people. But in the 1800s, there were, part of the problem is our larger fires have occurred mostly in, because they're not very frequent, there's not a whole lot of them you can point to. In recent years, the Biscuit Fire in southern Oregon was about 500,000 acres that burned there. And then there's been other wildfires in the rangeland, some of southeastern Oregon and Idaho and so forth, that have burned up to 500,000 acres or so at a stretch. So those sort of like 500,000 acres is not that unusual. Burning 3 to 3.5 million acres like the Big Burn in Idaho, that's still a pretty good sized fire record. But when they look back at Yellowstone's fire, for example, that burned about 1.5 million acres, I think is the figure, inside and outside of Yellowstone in 1988. And research has shown that that was not a particularly large fire by Yellowstone standards. In other words, they've done research where they've looked at fire in Yellowstone going back thousands of years, and they find every once in a while, with the right circumstances, there were much larger fires in the Yellowstone area. So it's not that unusual to have, a 1,000,000 acres burn in the Yellowstone area if you have a 5 or 6,000 year perspective on it, as an example. But if you're looking back in the last 100 years, well, that's the biggest fire that burned in Yellowstone last 100 years, so we think it's huge, just because we have the temporal scale we're using is so short.
So I've been driving on 199 from Crescent City to Medford, routinely every couple months for 12 years, and before I even moved to Crescent City, I drove 199 fairly often. I've been driving 199, Highway 199 for 35 years now, and I go through, there is part of the Biscuit Fire came down by 199, and my point is that the area that was burned by the Biscuit Fire, however many years ago that was, doesn't look bad, but there are some clear cuts that I drive by that were clear cuts 35 years ago that you can still tell are clear cuts.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying.
Yeah. Logging is not the same thing as a fire. It's interesting. On the edge of Yellowstone, on the Targhee National Forest, they had some massive clear cuts. In fact, had been the largest clear cuts up to recent times. that they could be seen from space, from satellite. They could, you could see a line along the border of Yellowstone Park where there were no trees. And these massive clear cuts, the Forest Service has, put up signs. They were replanted, or in some cases even, I think, some natural regeneration. But anyway, they have signs saying, you know, forest regenerated in 1986, or forest regenerated in 1984, or whatever, you know, sort of marking the date when they were logged. And, the interesting thing is that when you see the forest, there are trees growing back, but there's no snags in the mix of trees, and there's no snags on the forest floor. So these are, these stands are ecologically degraded stands. Whereas if you go into Yellowstone Park, 1988, there's still a lot of snags standing upright, and of course a lot of wood on the forest floor. And it's these periodic inputs of these dead trees. It's this biological legacy that supports all this other, living matter that, goes forward. For example, a number of years ago I was hiking in a part of Yellowstone, judging by the age of the trees, probably burned 50, 60 years before. And so by then there was a significant amount of trees that had fallen to the forest floor, so you have all these sort of path-rotted logs there. And as I walked along the trail, almost every single log had been torn apart by grizzly bears looking for ants. And the reason is that ants like to live in down logs. And I was thinking to myself, who would have thought 50 or 60 years before that that fire was creating grizzly bear habitat? But there you had it, right there, with all the logs that were torn up by the bears. And that is a good example of how something like a major forest fire can create habitat for decades afterwards. That, you know, it slowly changes from snags standing upright to logs on the ground, so it molders back into the duff on the forest floor, etc. At every stage, there's different animals and plants that rely on those biological legacies, and then those legacies help to support the next generation, you might say, of forests. Like aspen is a good example. Aspen will send up shoots from its roots after a major fire. So after you have a significant fire, you get all sorts of aspen regeneration, and aspen are an important tree for all sorts of bird species will nest in aspen trees. Elk like to browse on young aspen and so forth. So wildfires create a lot of aspen. A lot of people like to look at aspen. They're beautiful trees, too. And they are sort of set, reset every 50, 100, 150 years by fire. That's what helps to regenerate the aspen stands.
So you mentioned this. I think this is really important. You mentioned aspen sending up shoots. And you've said this, but I want you to really hit it, that when a fire comes through, even when it burns in a place, I've read that a lot of times it doesn't, a lot of even insects who can't get away very far, even they will do okay, because if they burrow just a few inches under the soil, or if they live just a little bit under the soil, the point I'm getting with the aspen is that even if it kills the trees above, there are still the root systems. It doesn't like sterilize the soil down to 100 meters.
Oh, exactly. No, most ecos up, and a lot of trees and shrubs are adapted to the root system surviving and then putting out new shoots. I mean, redwood trees are that way too. You're living in the redwood forest. They regularly send out new shoots when the main part of the tree dies for whatever reason. And we see that in all kinds of tree species and shrubs. A lot of the chaparral species in California, for example, will regrow after a fire from the root system. A lot of grasses, you know, the top part of the grass may burn off in a fire, but the roots don't, and by next spring the grass is, you know, very vigorous and growing well. A lot of you have some plants that are basically avoid the fire and somehow survive it. And you have others that have a strategy. A good one is lodgepole pine. That's common in Yellowstone Park that has what's called serotonin cones. The cones, and there are a lot of pines in California that are like this too, by the way. But they, the cones have a waxy substance that keeps them closed and keeps the seeds intact until they're heated. So after a fire, they open up a couple of days later, the cones on, left on the trees, and shower the soil with seeds, and within a few years, you have a young forest of lodgepole pine growing back. And so it almost, you could say, lodgepole pine welcomes, you know, if you want to anthropomorphize, welcomes the fire because it gets rid of all its competitors, which don't have this ability to shed seeds so quickly, and so it gets to sort of the, in the race for space and water and light, it gets the first shot at it, and other tree species have to take decades before they get large enough to shed seeds and recolonize it. And during that time, lodgepole pine basically has exclusive use of the territory.
So before we go, I want to do one more thing before we go back to the Forest Service. When was the big fire in Yellowstone?
1988.
And soon after that, there was a big controversy with a lot of anti-environmentalists saying, oh, Yellowstone's been destroyed. You mentioned wolves earlier, and we've talked, and I've talked, and you've talked, all of us have talked about the reintroduction of wolves and how that has helped Yellowstone. Can you talk about, can you sort of quickly, I mean, was Yellowstone destroyed by the fire? Or now, let's see, 1988, so that's 31 years later, what do the most severely burned areas look like?
Well, the very interesting thing that was found out in Yellowstone is that the places that were most severely burned had the highest regeneration of trees, the densest regeneration. Also, the most severely burned areas that have aspen are the areas that have the most abundant aspen regeneration. So it's sort of the opposite of what you would normally think. In other words, where there was the greatest mortality and the hottest fires is where we got the most regeneration in, throughout the park. And, you know, in terms of trying to say it was devastated or destroyed, it certainly wasn't, because large fires have been a common factor in the Yellowstone area for thousands of years, since the last ice age anyway. And the plants and animals there are used to these episodic and periodic large fires. And it's important to note they don't happen every year, and they're hundreds of years apart, and that, nevertheless, that's the normal way things go. There. So you go 200, 300, 400 years without a large fire, and then the right circumstances occur, and a fire will come through and kill the majority of the trees, and then you get the lodgepole seedlings coming up, or the aspen coming up, and then you go another couple hundred years before the next fire comes through. That's not to say that some areas won't have a fire in 20 years, because sometimes there's a reburn, but if you were to average this out over time, you'd find that fires are pretty much a common occurrence, but they're widely spaced in time.
Actually, I just remembered yet one more thing I want to talk about before we go to the Forest Service, which is somebody back in 2004 or so pointed out to me that the areas that had been knocked down by Mount St. Helens, the areas that had been knocked down and then left were in much, much better ecological shape only 20 some years after Mount St. Helens, than the areas where I believe it was the BLM had used Mount St. Helens as an excuse to go in and log. So even Mount St. Helens was not as devastating to the natural communities as was the BLM's logging afterwards?
Well, you have to remember that what happens when you log is, first of all, you're removing biomass from the forest ecosystem, and that biomass is wildlife habitat. That's where the insects are. That's where the birds feed. That's where they live. You're also, you know, the snags that are left have some interesting influences. For example, if you're in snow country, the snags actually act like a snow fence. So they trap snow, which means you get more moisture staying on that site. The same thing when there's a very interesting study was done in Yellowstone, showed that the water would fall on this on a down log and would roll towards the tip of the log, and over time that was a more water falling at the tip, and they had higher plant regeneration at the tips of these logs, so facilitated by the water rolling down. And you know, there's, and when you log, you're bringing in soil disturbance, you're bringing in weeds, you're bringing you're creating roads that are chronic sources of sedimentation. And this is another important point. After a fire, because so much of the plant life is underground in roots and responds very quickly to regrowth or is seeded very quickly by surrounding trees, shrubs, and flower seeds. Within a few years, sedimentation flows in streams declines greatly, often to back to before, you know, prior to the burn or even less than the burn. Whereas with logging roads, because they never go away, they're always there, they're leaking sediment continuously and has a negative impact on, say, fisheries. And that is one reason why, for example, even though fires and large fires have been a natural part of the landscape, you know, we successfully had salmon and trout and so forth survive all these centuries with wildfire. In fact, there are quite a few studies that show that those fish benefit from large wildfires. You get more food in insects in the stream. You have more down log in the stream, which creates habitat for the fish. All that disappears with logging, and instead what you get is sediment year after year after year with no break. And so that has a much more severe effect on the fisheries than, you know, 2 or 3 years of sediment input, and then it stops. And so it's a real difference, and Mount St. Helens would be an example of that too.
I keep pushing this off on the other topic. I'm going to do it again. That you mentioned that I live in Redwood. I live in, I guess it's third growth Redwood. And there's a lot of bears here, and the bears will sometimes, they like to eat some of the bark, and they will peel bark off. They like to eat the inner bark, and that's fine. And then sometimes they will girdle trees. And there was a tree that they girdled. It's a big, beautiful Doug fir that they girdled about 20, 30 feet up. So it's dead from there up. And that made me sad, and this is the classic thing back with that, you know, short-term habitat loss, long-term habitat gain. It made me sad because it's a big, beautiful tree, but then also it really made me look around this forest, and because it's only 50, 60 years old, it's exactly what you're talking about. There's not a lot of dead trees, dead standing trees. So on one hand, it made me sad for that tree, and on the other hand, it made me really glad because, in a, you know, whenever I've walked through old growth or even any sort of reasonably healthy natural community, I see a lot of dead trees. Just, I mean, even when it's not, even when it hasn't been burned recently, I mean, you walk through a forest and there's dead trees everywhere.
Well, there's 2 points I want to make on that observation, and you're correct. One, there are studies that show that in log areas, the dead trees that are on the ground are almost all relics from prior to the logging episode. And so, because they're no longer getting an input of new down wood. The second part of it is that what logging does is it sanitizes the forest. And even a lot of these so-called sustainably certified forest stands, Collins Pine is one that comes to mind. I visited there in Northern California, and I also visited one in the Redwood down near Santa Cruz. They're two good examples, but one of the things is I went through these, quote, sustainable forests, certified forests, was There's almost no down wood. There's no snags. That's the stuff that they eliminate now. Their idea of sustainable, in my view, is economic sustainability. In other words, that, you know, you come back 20 years from now, you still have enough wood, you know, to keep your mill going because you're not taking it all at one time. But that's not the same as ecological sustainability. And ecological sustainability relies on having a lot of dead material in the forest. And it's the, when we're doing the logging, we are degrading that forest ecosystem through whether you're thinning it, whether you're clear cutting it or whatever, because you're taking out this biomass. And I can't tell you at what level of wood removal doesn't have an effect or not a significant effect, but I can tell you that in my view, if it's economically viable logging, in other words, it's taking enough wood to make it worth doing, there's probably too much wood to be taking out in terms of a sustainable forest ecosystem.
Well, there is no surplus in nature. You know, every bite of salmon you eat is a bite that a grizzly bear or an insect can't. I'm not saying we should never eat, of course. I'm just saying that every bit of wood that's taken out would have been turned into something in the forest.
Exactly. And so this always brings up, you know, I get into multiple debates with you. Well, say you're going to stop not, you know, using wood, or you're going to stop eating or whatever. And that's not what I don't think that's a realistic choice. But I do want people to realize that there's no free lunch. And so the idea is the less of those things that you utilize, and don't be cavalier about the use of it, the better it probably is for the planet and all the other living things out there that depend on it. So, maybe you're going to use wood in a house construction, but maybe you keep the house, you know, you build a lot of the house with bricks or something else or stone and don't use as much wood. You keep the house small rather than large, so you don't use as much wood. Those are the kinds of choices one can make that will reduce the impact, because there will always be an impact, but reduce the impact that we humans have on the rest of life out there.
So we have about 6 minutes left, which is really funny because we have done a 42-minute introduction to the topic for a 6-minute discussion, which is great. Because it's A, a joy to speak with you, and B, you always have so much, this is so important for people to understand, and C, you know, the Forest Service argument is, you have shown with all this introduction how ridiculous it is. I'm gonna read a comment by, the Secretary of the USDA, Sonny Perdue, and then I would like for you to spend a few minutes responding to it.
Okay.
We are committed to doing the work to protect people and infrastructure from catastrophic wildfire, says Sonny Perdue. With millions of acres in need of treatment, so it's like you can just rip every word of this apart, you know, with millions of acres in need of treatment, years of costly analysis and delays are not an acceptable solution, especially when data and experience show us we can get this work done with strong environmental protection standards as well as protect communities, livelihoods, and resources.
All right. Well, let me break apart that. Don't go any further.
No, that's it. That's
you're
the whole
get
thing.
Too far ahead.
That's
okay.
The whole thing.
Well, first of all, catastrophic fires are not any are actually a completely natural event. The term catastrophic is pejorative. I use the term large wildfires. The second thing is that there is pretty good evidence from many different studies, as well as anecdotal evidence, that shows that under extreme wildfire conditions, that is, with the drought, the wind, the low humidity, nothing stops the wildfire, because burning embers are blown miles ahead of a fire front. And so thinning the forest, clear-cutting the forest, doing anything like that to, quote, reduce fuels, has very little effect, because the only, you'd have to reduce fuels over, you know, basically eliminate forests from most of the landscapes in order to have any significant effect. So
hey,
the whole proposition that doing thinning or logging over a large area is going to significantly safeguards immunities is bogus. What will safeguard immunities, and this has been shown by many studies, is by reducing the flammability of the individual homes in the area surrounding it. And that means making sure you don't have things, fine fuels, which again is what burns in fires. You don't have things like pine needles on your roof and in your gutters. You don't have grass growing right up to the edge of the house. Build a deck. If you have a deck, try to build it out of a non-wooden substance that's more fire resistant. Have screens on the vents of your attic so that embers don't get blown into the attic. And even little things that people don't think about, like some studies have shown that doggy doors are a great entranceway for burning materials to be blown into the house, because, you know, the doggy doors are made to go back and forth. And if you've got a 60-mile-an-hour or 70-mile-an-hour wind, it'll blow that door right open and in with it the fire. So that's how we reduce the fire in communities and safeguard communities. We don't do it by trying to log the forest. In fact, there is also evidence that shows that logging the forest actually enhances fire spread. Because, again, if you think about what are the things that help a fire spread, it's wind and it's drying things out. Well, when you open up the forest by thinning, you wind up opening up the forest to greater drying and wind penetration. And it's not surprising, and again, studies show that north-facing slopes that are in tend to be moister because they're on north-facing, but they also have more fuel than a south-facing slope. They're the ones that burn at the lowest severity or don't burn at all in major fires. And so there's all this sort of evidence out there showing that the premise of which activity of logging the forest is based as a mechanism for safeguarding communities is a false premise. And certainly not a good strategy, except in a very local situation. In other words, you know, it's been shown that if you can reduce the number of trees, particularly small trees, within 100 feet of a house, that will safeguard your house. Going much beyond 100 feet doesn't really give you any added benefit.
So I would like for you to address, we just have like a minute or two left, I would like for you to address specifically this notion, and the Forest Service puts this out all the time, that they have to disallow environmental review of projects, but they won't be environmentally destructive. And doesn't it seem self-evident that if it wasn't going to be environmentally destructive, that you wouldn't have to bypass environmental review?
Exactly. And I would also say that this is where you would be able to show through the scientific evidence that the whole assumptions behind the projects are incorrect. You know, this is the thing, if I have just a little bit of time, I want to make this point, is that, you know, thinning forests and so forth may prevent or make it easier to put out a fire burning under low to medium kind of fire weather conditions. But you can put out fires anyway, whether you've thinned or not under those conditions. But the conditions that of severe fire weather, especially with high winds, like you get in California, Santa Ana's, and so forth, you can't significantly change a fire that's burning under those conditions. And so it's very important. Those fires are not very common. There's not very many of them, but they're always in the news all the time. And those are the ones that the Forest Service is telling people they're going to try to prevent or limit, yet they're the very fires that all the evidence shows that they can't do it. And if you read carefully a lot of these scientific papers on wildfire, they may be saying, oh, well, thinning showed it, you know, we were able to change fire behavior, blah, blah, blah. But they'll usually have some qualifier, if they're honest, somewhere in the paper saying, however, this does not apply when there's extreme fire weather conditions. But that's why it's such a joke, because the extreme fire weather conditions are the only time we have fires that we're really concerned about. A fire burning under low fire conditions, like when they do a prescribed burn, they don't go anywhere. So you don't have to worry about them. They're not a concern for communities or anything. But when you have that extreme fire weather, you can't stop them. So it's really important to understand that though that there are very few fires that burn under those extreme conditions, they account for like 95 to 99% of the acreage burned annually. And they may be, you know, 25 or 50 fires that are out of tens of thousands of fires that burn that kind of acreage. And when you have those conditions, nothing stops them.
So the very last thing I would like for you to say very quickly is you said that I mean, it's in your bio that you're the executive director of Public Lands Media. That's a new thing. Can you give us a 30-second story of what Public Lands Media is?
Well, what I try to do is, kind of what you've heard me doing here, I read a lot of research and I try to summarize it and put it into terms that people can relate to with their common experience without necessarily having a, you know, a strong science or ecological background. And I try to do that through, you know, radio interviews like this, writing editorials, and also sending out, you know, I get requests from people constantly where they say, hey, you know, I've heard this or that about this topic. Do you have any, papers that, scientific papers that may discuss this topic? And since I'm sort of monitoring all that stuff and often saving things that I think are important, we're sending out summaries of that research, that's helpful to other people that are engaged in these issues. And so that's kind of the role I play, and I try to use my science background to popularize some of these ideas.
Well, thank you so much for being on the program, and thank you for your decades of fighting for the wildlands. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been George Werthner. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.